Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, this razor-sharp 92-year-old performed top-secret duties in World War II that led to a significant development.
The radio man picked up a message with his name on it from Tokyo, and they immediately put three or four more men on that same wavelength.
Whose name would that be? Let this Navy veteran tell you today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. The idea is that no matter where your hometown might be in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it is, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done a lot more than you realize for the sake of freedom. That freedom that we enjoy every day and often take for granted. So every time we visit with a veteran of World War II, we want to preserve his stories for posterity, make sure he knows how much we appreciate his service and sacrifice, and along the way be educated about what life was like back then and glean some of those lessons that are still relevant today. That's the idea today with 92-year-old Harry Mercer of Tulare, California, but originally from a small town in Montana. How big was the spot where you grew up?
About 18,000 people when I was a kid in high school.
And that's a big city in Montana in 1940s. That's Missoula, where the University of Montana is.
Right.
What was life like growing up as one of five children in hunting and fishing country up in the Northwest?
Well, you pretty well named it. That was our whole life was centered around hunting and fishing and going to school and playing baseball and basketball, etc. It was a wonderful life. I'm very sorry that my grandchildren never have a chance to experience that.
Well, maybe you'll have to get them up there sometime. You can take them to the national headquarters of the Boone and Crockett Club there in the old train station in Missoula. There's a lot to see on the walls there. I've been there. Did you, as you were growing up, a teenager, a high schooler there in Missoula, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do with your life and where you were going to go?
None whatsoever, although I wanted to be a doctor. But in those days, you didn't have advisors that knew what they were doing or really cared. And when I graduated from high school and went to University of Montana, I found out that I had to go back to school for a couple more years before I could qualify for a pre-med course. And, of course, that knocked that into a cocked hat. So I quit school at the end of 2 years. I accepted a job with Pacific Fruit and Produce Company, and they were smart enough. They were looking for young undergraduates. They didn't want graduates because they'd have to pay them too much. And they wanted to take the young kids and put them into their system and teach them their own expertise. And they did that with me. I started out for 60 cents an hour for Pacific Fruit and Produce Company for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, they kept their word. They took me out of the warehouse and hauling watermelons and sacks of potatoes around. And they put me in a nice little sedan delivery and gave me $40 a week. When I started out, I was making $18 a week. But they raised me to $40 a week, gave me a clothing and a food allowance. And boy, I had money cut out of my ears.
I guess so. That was a lot of money back then. But there couldn't have been all those crops in Missoula. Where was that you had to move?
It was in Marshfield, Oregon. Coos Bay, Oregon at that time. My wife and I were married there, and our first child was born in Coos Bay. And we've been back almost every year ever since, till last year. I lost my wife in September. I don't do much traveling anymore. But I've had a wonderful life.
Well, and let me ask you about that. Did you meet your wife there in Coos Bay?
No. I met my wife in Missoula, Montana, in the middle of winter. And the Lions Club always flooded a vacant lot with water and to make a skating rink for the local kids. And I was skating with a bunch of friends of mine, and we were playing Snap the Whip. And I was at the end of the whip, and they snapped me, and I sailed across that ice at about 50 miles an hour and caught my wife. I didn't know her. But all of a sudden, she was in front of me, and I hit her full blast. I knocked her down, knocked her out completely. She was unconscious. The first person she saw when she came up was my face above her, and she wanted to do nothing but punch me. But I talked her into going out on a date with me the next night, as a matter of fact. And on that date, I had an old Model A Ford, and she was sitting there alongside of me. And after we'd gone to dinner and went to a show, and I was entranced with her. I'd never seen anybody like Gemma before or since. And I told her then, I said, "You might as well get used to seeing me because I'm going to marry you." And she looked at me like I was crazy. And of course, she didn't believe me. But 2 years later, we were married. And both young kids didn't know what was going on really, except that we loved each other. And we had 72 years of marriage together. People laugh, but we never had a fight. We had some disagreements, but my mother and dad were special people, and so were hers. And they talked to us when we just told them we wanted to get married. And they asked us to try to duplicate their marriages, both my parents and her parents, because they had been married for a number of years and got along very well. They were wonderful people. And so we adopted the policy. If one of us had a problem, we'd write it down and give the other one a note telling her or him what the problem might be. And then we'd sit and talk about it. And we were never, ever able not to resolve our question, and always ended up, well, we had five children, so you knew we got along pretty well.
I guess so, and I'm glad I asked that question. I don't know if I've ever had an answer quite like that to how you met your wife. You knocked into her on the ice and knocked her out cold. That's a new one, but I guess it's a good thing it worked out that way. And you two got married just a few months before the whole world changed a little bit. You guys were still newlyweds when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
We were married 4 months before Pearl Harbor, and we were living in Marshfield, Oregon, or Coos Bay. The week following Pearl Harbor, they actually, a Japanese submarine surfaced off Coos Bay and sank a lumber freighter there and lobbed shells into the Coos Bay Harbor. We woke up one morning and all kinds of, we lived up on a hill overlooking Coos Bay, and we heard this terrible racket and looked out the window, and they were setting up a machine gun emplacement in our front yard, overlooking the Coast Guard station, which was right down below us. They never had occasion to be attacked or anything, but they thought they were going to be. So it came home with a vengeance that we were at war. I quit my job with Pacific Fruit, and I went up to Seattle and went to work in the Navy Yard so that I would have a deferred occupation. And I worked there with my oldest brother, and we had a lot of memories of Seattle. We eventually bought a home up there. My God, you're bringing back memories I haven't thought of for many, many years.
Well, and you say deferred occupation, but that wouldn't be deferred forever. Both of you would end up serving, as well as your other brother. Three boys and two girls in your family, and all three of you boys went on to serve in the war. Who went in first among you three brothers?
He was 4 years older than I was. He went into the Air Force first, and then I was drafted, and then after I was drafted, my older brother was drafted, and we both ended up in the Navy. It was an interesting experience. My experience with Pacific Fruit and Produce Company is what got me into Navy intelligence, because there weren't too many young men who knew how to operate an electric keyboard in those days. And we had a teletype set up through Pacific Fruit that extended all up and down the Pacific coast. And I learned to use it, and That was on my application when they drafted me. I tried to enlist in the Marines, but they wouldn't have me. I had a trick knee. I had bad eyes. I had a history of asthma. So they wouldn't take me in the Marines. But the Navy offered to take me because of my experience with the teletype. And they promised me that I could go into the Navy if I would accept that. And they would waive all the physical requirements. Well, what a joke that was. I went into boot camp. I've got the picture of our group over in Farragut training camp, Farragut, Idaho. And I went through boot camp there. And then they sent me back to Washington, D.C. And being a reporter, you probably be interested to know, where I took my training in Washington, D.C. was at the National Press Club. And the reason for that, in the second story of the National Press Club, they had the most sophisticated setup on radio and teletype and communication setup of any concern in the world. The Navy didn't have anything like it, neither did the Marines or anybody else. So they put us there to take our training on the electronic equipment. From there, I went to Bainbridge Island, Seattle. From there, I went to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii to Guam, and eventually back home. But I really had some wonderful experiences.
What was it like for you to be so young, to be married, then to become a father, to have even your second child while this whole war is going on, and while you're part of the war? Was that nerve-wracking? Did it feel like a lot of responsibility for you to have all that you're dealing with?
Well, you have to understand, back then, we had been attacked. We were fighting the Nazis in Europe, and we were fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. And it's kind of hard to realize that in this day and age, but every young man that was of an age that he could go and fight wanted to, because our country was under siege and people were being killed by other people. Well, naturally, we wanted to fight back. And I hated to leave my wife, but she was of the same opinion. She thought, yes, I should go, just like millions of other wives sent their husbands to go. It was just inconceivable that somebody would not want to go into the service and fight our enemies. So everybody did. Now, there's very few people my age that are not veterans of one or two or even three wars.
And most veterans I talk to will talk about the letters they got from their wives and how much they meant to them. In your position in Navy intelligence, I bet it was hard for you to write much of anything to her without it being censored.
It was very hard because I couldn't write anything without being censored. I filled my letters with chit-chat about what I was doing and how I felt physically, and I went to a lot of interesting places. I've always been an artist from the time I was in grade school. I used to always draw pictures of the other kids, and I mentioned the V-mail that we had available. So I never sent home a letter that I didn't have a drawing of some kind in it, and that had made it easy for my wife.
She had a little piece of you with every one of those V-mails. What about your brothers and what they were doing? Did you have any idea what they were up to, whether they were in danger or how the war was going for them?
Yes, I did. My next oldest brother was in New Zealand, and of course he wrote letters home to my mother, and she shared them always with us. And my oldest brother was sent back to the Great Lakes Naval Training Station and ended up on a destroyer escort that carried a contingent of Navy SEALs. And he came out into the Pacific, and they made landings on a succession of islands. He visited me in Guam. I was laying in my bunk, or my cot, fast asleep. We had canvas cots with mosquito netting up over them, and I woke up. I was flying through the air, and I lit on the floor with my cot on top of me, and my brother was standing there laughing like a fool. he had reached down and picked up the edge of the cot and just threw it into the air with me in it, and he thought that was really funny. He was about 7 years older than I was, so I was just a punk kid to him. But it's an interesting thing. I went down to the landing at the fleet landing and went aboard his ship, and I found out that his captain, he was a water tender aboard that little ship. The captain was depending on him to the point where he had kept it from him that he was eligible for discharge. He had more than enough points to come home, but they didn't tell him that. They were at sea most of the time, so he didn't have any way of getting that information. But anyway, I braced the captain and told him, I want my brother to go home. He's got a couple kids at home. He needs to be there. You've got no damn business keeping him here any longer. Well, he listened to me, and he got out all the papers and filled them out. And before I left there, my brother was on his way home.
So he went home before you did. And speaking of going home, and I know your brother in the Air Corps had tons of missions in B-17s and was highly decorated. When you think about the fact that all three of you were out there doing what your country asked of you, and all three of you came home, does that impress you, given how many people didn't come home?
Listen, we were tough kids. We were used to fending for ourselves, and we were lucky. There's no really any explanation why I got the ability to do what I did.
And we need to talk about what you did in the U.S. Navy in World War II. I'm glad you can talk about it now, because for so long you couldn't. But first, we need to take a break. 92-year-old Harry Mercer of Tulare, California is our guest today. Find some photos of him on our Facebook page, and don't go anywhere, because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 92-year-old Harry Mercer, served in Naval Intelligence during World War II. Next month, he's going to be one of nearly 75 World War II veterans on the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight. He'll have a chance to experience the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. Harry actually spent part of World War II in our nation's capital, training for the secret work that he did. And you really did need to keep a lot of things secret, didn't you, Harry?
When I was in Washington, D.C., they impressed on us right from the start the extreme caution that we had to have in talking about any of our work. And so they didn't house us in an ordinary barrack with other sailors. There was a young woman, she was not young, about 40 at that time. Her name was Helen Gagan Douglas, and she was a United States congresswoman. Her husband had been a congressman, and he died of a heart attack, and they put her into his seat in Congress, and they gave me a lodging in her home in Washington, D.C., while I was taking my training, myself and another friend of mine. I'm still in touch with him. He's also 92 and lives in Denver, Colorado, and we call and talk on the phone. The last time I called him, I said I hated to do that because I was afraid he was gone. And he said, well, Merce, I haven't called you for exactly the same reason. I have my high school annuals and my wife's high school academy manuals from Missoula, Montana, and I was looking through those the other day, and I can say with great certainty that I am the only remaining member of the class of 1938, the Missoula Spartans, that is still alive. That all the rest of them are gone. I went through it with a fine-tooth comb, and I knew that they were gone, and some of them I had questions about, and I made inquiries and found out that they too were gone. And my wife was in exactly the same situation. She was the last remaining member of her class of 1938 in Academy in Missoula, Montana. Why? I don't know. I figure that I still have things to do and places to go, but I don't have any control over that. It'll come, and I'll do what I'm kept here to do.
Yeah, it's hard to look at everything you've been through and feel like God didn't have a plan for you in all of this.
He does.
Well, and you talk about your work, and it was so sensitive that even where they housed you was something of great concern, so you wouldn't have the opportunity for loose lips to sink ships. And it wasn't just back then that this was secret. You weren't able to talk about a lot of this for a long time.
For a long time. They offered me a job in the State Department, offered to teach me Russian and go underground, and some of my friends did that, and some of them disappeared. I never knew what happened to them, but they went into Russia. Because at the time that I was in Bainbridge Island, and I had my orders to go to Wahiawa in the Hawaiian Islands, I had had trouble with my typewriter, and so I was looking for a new one. And somebody told me they had a shipment of new typewriters in the warehouse. So I went down. I had no business doing that, but I did it anyway. It's a good thing I didn't get caught, or I would have been speaking from Leavenworth yet today. At the time we were in Bainbridge, they were monitoring all the Japanese radio traffic. We knew everything the Japanese were doing, and that will lead me to Yamamoto. I opened a carton and looked in there, and this was a year before the war with Japan ended. And in there, we had typewriter after typewriter after a whole shipment full of typewriters with Russian characters on them. So there were some of our people in the same outfit. I was in, they called it joint communication activities, and there were some of our people were already monitoring Russia a year before the war with Japan ended. Anyway, to get back to this presidential unit citation.
Yeah, and you have here your U.S. Navy League hat. You got involved in the U.S. Navy League after you got out of the service and had incredible experiences with them, even became the national president of the Navy League. But on that hat, you've got a ribbon there, and it's a big hunk of green in the middle, and then stripes of red, gold, and blue. And that's for the presidential unit citation, but you weren't allowed to tell anyone why you received that?
I could tell the ribbon. And I could tell him it was a presidential unit citation, but I couldn't tell him what I did to get it.
And when did that finally change?
About 2 years ago.
How did you find out it was okay to talk about it finally?
I saw a TV program telling about it, and here was a fellow that was in our outfit, and he was talking freely about it. So I wrote the Navy Department and asked, and they said, yes, your record has been cleared, and you can talk about it now. I said, well, why didn't you tell me? They said, well, he was just another Navy guy.
So I'm sure people's ears are really perking up now to hear what this classified work you guys were doing was.
Well, our radio men were monitoring all the Japanese traffic, and they all spoke Japanese, and they read Japanese, and as they would copy it down, then they would send, they'd have big rolls of tape that would fit into a teletype machine. And the radio men would bring their tape in. We'd run it through the teletype machine. We called it the Enigma machine. The cryptology people, they went through it before we got it. If there was something that was sensitive or something that was of interest, we would then type that up in 5-digit letters. and I used to be able to type 100 words a minute. I could pile the tape on the floor, feeding it into the machine, and cut tape 100 words a minute to where it would pile up on the floor, and I could get up and go get a cup of coffee and come back before it ran out. I can't do that anymore.
What would you do it on anyway? And to be clear, so you're saying you would type it not in plain English, but in a code that you had been specifically trained to use.
And then after we put it in the code, we'd insert that tape into the Enigma machine, and it would send it by wireless telegraph directly to Washington, D.C. And then they would look at it. And there's a little aside there. While the attack on Pearl Harbor was supposed to be a complete surprise, it was not. I found out the later years that there were from people who were in our division and were on at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese attack. A PBY from the Navy found the Japanese task force 200 miles northwest of Pearl Harbor and radioed the information back to our unit in Pearl Harbor. And we encoded that information and sent it to Washington, D.C. I didn't.
You weren't there yet. You would be at that outpost later, but yeah.
It went to Washington, D.C., and they sat on it because I found out the scuttlebutt was, I can't prove it, but I think it's probably right, that President Roosevelt at that time, he was under fire by the entire United States people. They wanted to impeach him because they wanted the war to be over. They didn't want any more war, just about like it is today. He did a lot of things. He sent ships and supplies and money to England to help them fight Hitler when he really had no authorization from Congress to do it. Thank God he did. He was a savior of this country.
And I just want to be clear, because a lot of people, some people have heard this kind of stuff, and others are saying, whoa, you're rocking my world here. What is he talking about? So you're saying, because later you were stationed at Pearl Harbor in this cryptology department in Naval Intelligence, and you worked with people who had been there in December of 1941 who knew because they had passed on these messages to Washington. Say they knew the intelligence had come before the attack.
It did. It reached Washington, D.C., and it was, I believe it was on a Sunday, and they just, nobody was at work. Well, deliberate or non-deliberate, you tell me. But it was common, became common knowledge that Churchill and President Roosevelt had a very close relationship, and they both understood that the United States and England, too, were sick of war. The war was over in Europe, but when we were attacked, and then it became public knowledge, and a lot of our people were killed, the nation as a whole just came up in arms, and everybody was ready to go after the Japanese, and we did. If there's any credence to that story, I couldn't swear to it, but I believe it's true.
And we do know that sleeping giant did awake, and you and your brothers were part of that. Let's hear a little more about your work in naval intelligence, whether you were there at Pearl Harbor or on Guam. You're passing on these intercepted messages. What examples can you give us of some of the content of those messages that you passed on?
This presidential unit citation was for finding and killing Admiral Yamamoto. The radio man picked up a message with his name on it from Tokyo, and they immediately put three or four more men on that same wavelength, and they copied everything about it for about 3 days, and there was all kinds of traffic, and he was scheduled to go on an inspection trip to the little island of Rabaul, which was one of the fortresses of Japan in the Pacific. So as a result, from the information that they got, we knew what kind of plane he was flying in, what his departure time was, what his approximate arrival time over Rabaul was going to be, what his escort was going to be, and a lot of other information. We made arrangements through the Navy, brought six P-38s up from New Zealand, and they chose the P-38 because it was a twin-engine airplane. and it had the capacity to carry extra fuel tanks. They gave them the radio information. They took off. It was all volunteer. Every one of those men volunteered for a flight of no return, literally. And all but one of them got back. They went into the ocean. They lit on some of the little primitive runways that had been hacked into the island. But they met Yamamoto on the way into Rabaul, and they shot him down. There were two different planes that both claimed that they shot him down. Well, I think probably they both did, because they were all going after him. But none of them made it back to New Zealand.
You know, for people of my generation, to help them put this in perspective, they've been through what our country's been through recently. And Osama bin Laden, you know, the mastermind of 9/11, and the SEAL team that hunted him down. This is just about as significant, because Yamamoto is the architect of Pearl Harbor. And so this was, even though it's just one plane shot down, for the morale of the country, that was big.
It was a terrible blow. It was a blow equivalent to somebody blowing Eisenhower out of the air over prior to the invasion in Germany. It was a terrible blow to the Japanese people. When they shot him down, he went into the jungle in Rabaul, and we heard, and this is pure scuttlebutt, it's just what we heard, that they sent a jungle team of Australians that were trained in that. They went into Rabaul, and they found that airplane. And they found Yamamoto, indeed, dead in that airplane, dressed in his full-dress uniform with his ceremonial sword strapped on his side. And they had to make a decision. Did they want to tell the Japanese people or not? And that wasn't a decision that our guys could make. So that had to be cleared from Washington. And they decided to not tell anybody about it. And then, if I remember correctly, it was about 4 months later, somebody found his plane and found him in it. He was still in his uniform, but he was just a skeleton. But his ceremonial sword was gone. Now, that's pure scuttlebutt again, but it makes a good story.
It does make for a great story, and there are a couple other versions of that floating around that you can investigate online. I actually made reference earlier to a quote so many of us are familiar with, and it has been attributed to Admiral Yamamoto, mostly because of its use in the classic film Tora, 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 when Yamamoto said after the attack on Pearl Harbor, "I fear all we have done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." We all know that's exactly what happened, but there is debate over whether Yamamoto actually uttered those words. Anyway, it's been a fascinating journey with Harry Mercer, and we're not done yet. The rest of Hometown Heroes, right after this.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 92-year-old Harry Mercer of Tulare, California, a World War II Navy veteran originally from Missoula, Montana. We've heard about the role his intelligence unit played in the shooting down of Admiral Yamamoto's plane in 1943.
And I'm sure there are a lot of more mundane messages that you passed on over the years, but was it ever a burden for you to have to keep so many things a secret and to know that you really couldn't talk about this with anyone?
No, not really, because we all understood it so well. That old saying, loose lips sink ships. Well, it was certainly true. And the Japanese were monitoring our radio as well as we were monitoring theirs, but they didn't or were not able to break our code. We had a little machine, they called it an Enigma machine, and we would change the settings on that. They were a series of little discs, and you just move that disc a quarter of a turn, and it was a whole new ballgame, thousands of potential combinations. And we all understood that, hell, we were at war. It wasn't a game, and there were people being killed every day, ships being sunk and planes shot down, and on the island of Guam, even 9 months after the war was over, they were still digging Japanese out of the caves that did not recognize the war was over, and they came out shooting. The Marines killed a lot of them. I almost got the closest I ever came to getting killed. I never had to carry a gun, but the Navy was pretty smart. In our joint communications activity, it was out in the jungle on Guam, and they went out there with bulldozers, and they dug actually like a basement, excavated a huge area there. Then they poured concrete and cement walls. What happened in the result is that our workshop, when we went in, we went down into a basement. We were sitting at our desk working. Well, our heads were below the line of the earth outside, and we were sitting there. One night, the Japanese had come out of the caves, and they'd brought a little 25 caliber machine gun, set it up outside our compound, and they just stitched a row of bullet holes, but they stitched it at what they would have presumed to be waist height, so it went over our head, and the ricochet all over hell, but nobody was hurt. Well, after about the first second of those reports, we heard bang, bang. Then the Marines that were up in the lookouts above it, they saw that going on, and there were two of them. They killed them. But if we had indeed been sitting on ground level, that guy or those people would have killed a whole bunch of us. That's kind of an odd little story, but it's true.
Yeah, and the reality of that is there would have been a wife without a husband, two kids without a father, and three more kids who had never been born. So I'm sure your family is
sure
thankful. What was life like on Guam? And I know you made lots of sketches during that time. You still have a lot of them. I'm sure there are some eye-opening experiences for you living on that island at that time.
Well, there were. The average temperature there was over 100 degrees. And it was very often up to 118 or 120. So we were out in the middle of the jungle. It was kind of a special group. They weren't too many of them were career Navy people, as you would think of it. They weren't bosun's mates and a special skill. But our dress code was really relaxed. Most of the time I wore wooden clogs, no socks, just wooden clogs, shorts or skivvies. They weren't real shorts, they were just underpants, no shirt, and a pith helmet. And that was our uniform of the day, pretty much. Nobody thought anything of it. We didn't have any real reason to keep a spit and polish installation going. I was lucky. The unit that I was in, one of the officers was a professor of English at Stevens College in Washington, D.C. He was a nice guy. Commander Inman was his name, and he had a command car that was issued to him. There really wasn't any chain of command like there is in the normal Navy. Everybody was working. Everybody did a job. Everybody was important, and they were all just ordinary people. I got acquainted with Commander Inman, and we got to be pretty good friends, and he took me out into the jungle quite frequently because he had clearance to go into the native settlements, and he would take me with him just for company, if nothing else. I have some pictures of the Guamanians. They were beautiful people. When the Japanese attacked Guam, they bombarded the island. Then they made daily flights in their little washing machine engines. Then they'd fly over the jungle, and they'd look for patterns of food, vegetables and pineapples and so forth. And if they were planted in regular rows, it would show up from the air. So we had to tell them to stop doing that and just plant a bunch here and a bunch here and a bunch there, which they did, and they were successful in raising food for themselves while they were under Japanese occupation.
Yeah, things that never would occur to you until something like that comes up. And you mentioned interacting with the inhabitants of the island, and I did see a picture in there of you with, it looks like a little Guamanian boy on your shoulders. What's the story there?
Well, we went out to talk to the chief of the village. We had a member of our group that stayed on Guam during the entire Japanese occupation, and he lived in the caves alongside out in the jungle. And the Guamanian people took care of him and fed him, and he helped them any way that he could. They were able to smuggle letters out and put them into the doorways. I don't know how they did it, but he kept funneling information about the Japanese occupation all the time that he was there. And after the Americans retook the island, he told the chief of the Guamanian people, I don't know what they called him, he said, I want to do something for you. What would you like to have more than anything in the world? And the guy said, a new Chevrolet car. And believe it or not, the Navy got it for him.
And I guess if I'm doing my math right, Guam is where you were when the war came to an end. And something tells me your job gave you a little more heads up that that was happening than the average Navy man.
Oh, yeah. We knew what was going on. We also understood the reason why we had to stay. There were so many young kids going home that had been in the service before we even got started. So we all had to wait our turn. We didn't like it, but now that brings up a totally different story. I was scheduled to come home on a Liberty ship, and for some reason or the other, that Liberty ship was disabled, and it couldn't go. Well, down in the harbor at Guam, there was a little flotilla of three LCIs, Landing Craft Infantry, and they had made the trip through the Panama Canal and over to Guam, and now the war was over, and all of those kids had been on those ships for 3 and 4 years, so they were all eligible for immediate discharge, and they took off. They found transportation home, and they left those three LCIs stranded in Guam with no crew. Well, we found out about it. Don't ask me how. The fellows that were eligible for discharge in our outfit, we volunteered to act as a crew if they'd take us back to Pearl Harbor, and they jumped at the opportunity. None of us had ever served aboard ship, but we were all young, we were healthy, and we were smart, and all we needed was somebody to tell us what to do, and we could do it. So we started out for Pearl Harbor on board one of those little ships. There were 17 of us, and we didn't even get 100 miles from Guam till a typhoon hit. It was a dandy. It broke the bow clear off of a big cruiser about 50 miles from us. It blew us off course. For a week, we didn't know where we were. Our radio was out, and we could only make about 5 or 6 knots. The seas were just unbelievable. You could look up as high as you could see, the water was above you. Then when you'd start down, as far as you could see down, There was nothing below you but water. But anyway, it took us 30 days to go from Guam to Pearl Harbor. And we ended up about 800 miles off course. And I got a look at Eniwetok, which I would not have gotten otherwise.
I'm sure you also got a look at your life flashing in front of your eyes a few times and wondering if you guys made a mistake.
None of us slept below deck. We all slept up on deck. There were 50 caliber gun emplacements, two of them on the rear and two of them up in front. There were three of us could get in there side by side and put our feet against one end and our hands up against, and no matter how the ship was rolling or pitching or smashing, we could stay pretty solid. That was an experience. Fortunately for me, there was one of our kids had a camera, and he used up all the film that he had, and I have pictures of that trip home.
Well, everybody wants to see those. We'll have to put those on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I've got to ask you, before we run out of time, what it felt like to get back home again, to see your wife again, and to see these two kids who really you're kind of getting to know all over again. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was like going in your house and going from one room to another and closing the door behind you. It wasn't a big transition. We all wanted it so bad, and we were so glad to see our family and our friends. It wasn't hard to close the door on where you had been. We were just so damn glad to get away from it. After I was home, the Navy contacted me and offered me a job in the State Department with one of the requirements that I would have to learn Russian. And I said, no way. I had no interest in pursuing any further career in the Navy at all, nor did anybody else that I knew of. Some of the guys did stay in. It repaid them well, because you could retire in 20 years.
What you were doing during World War II was so advanced technologically than what most of the civilians knew was even out there at that time. Were you able to take any of that work from the Navy and employ the skills you picked up in your career in civilian life?
Yes, I went back to work for Pacific Fruit and Produce Company for a short period of time. Then I went back home, and my two brothers and I, we formed a partnership, and we bought up every piece of property that we could find in Missoula, Montana, that was for sale. The general consensus was that with all of the kids coming back from the service, there weren't going to be enough jobs for anybody. We felt that I had an old friend of the family. He advised us, boys, get all the land that you can, because in the beginning, God created the earth, and then he created man. And since that day, he's created millions of men, but he's never created one additional acre of earth. So get all the land you can, and it will take care of you. And it did.
We're just about out of time, but I know that the Navy League has been real important in your life, too, and it's given you some incredible experiences. I have pictures of you here on the deck of the nuclear USS Enterprise, the second Enterprise. You've been on all kinds of ships, and you can walk around with hats from all these different ships. People probably think you served on them. National president of the Navy League for a while, been at Pearl Harbor laying wreaths on the Arizona Memorial. What did you get? What have you gotten out of your continuing association with the Navy League?
Pride. I'm very proud of it. They gave me a lot of opportunities because I was willing to go. When they'd have an opening somewhere, I spent 1 week over at the San Diego where the submarine fleet was there. And I always wanted to go aboard a nuclear sub. Nobody could do that. It was just a closed door. But the Commodore, he came to visit us at Navy League in El Centro and gave us talk to us. And when he did that, I presented him with a T-Bone Award like I have on my wall. And he invited me to come over to San Diego. So I did that. And my wife and I went and we had lunch with him. He said, now, what's really on your mind? I said, I'd give my left ear to go aboard one of those attack submarines that you have out there, not the old one. I've been aboard the old Bowfin. So he arranged for a guided tour for my wife and myself on one of the brand new attack nuclear submarines. And what an experience that was. I had dinner with them in their little bitty dining room, and I had the run of the ship. The only place I couldn't go was in where the nuclear engines were. They had a door there with a covered glass in it. You could look through it, and they could look at you. No, no way. I didn't have the credentials to go in there. But that was really an experience. And then he did something else. I learned to fly in Montana in the middle of winter in a little Piper Cub on skis. And while that sounds exciting, it was really pretty simple, because all you had to do when you landed would pull your nose up and fly into the ground, and the end of the ski would catch it and slap you down into a perfect three-point landing. Well, they had a replica of the control portion of the nuclear sub was built on gimbals, just like the old little deal that they had to help you learn to fly, the Link Trainer. Well, they had a huge, tremendous, oversized Link Trainer, and he set me in the control panel on this nuclear sub replica. There was a bosun mate behind me, and he told me what to look for and what to do. And then they turned on the sound effects, and I could hear the water swishing by. I could hear all the engines. I could hear people talking in the background. I could hear whistles. And then finally he leaned forward and he said, "Dive, dive, dive." And I had a hold of the steering wheel and I pushed it forward, and down we went. And that thing turned up on its nose and we dived, went down, 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 level off. And I pulled it back, and they had a turn and climb indicator there, just like on an airplane. And he had told me to watch for that and to keep it level. And if I'd do that, I wouldn't have any problem. And I didn't. Well, I flew that submarine around the bottom of the Pacific Ocean for about 45 minutes. And then finally, they said, "Surface, surface." And I pulled it back. Up we went. And that thing shot out of the water. Now, I wasn't in the water, but I was in the water. That was so real. That thing came out and then came down. Splash! And bobbed up and down a little bit, cut the engine, and that was the end of it. That was so real to me. Nobody could have told me I wasn't driving that submarine.
I think there are a lot of Navy guys out there that are jealous now that they heard you tell that story of that sub simulator. I want to make sure that I say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for entertaining us with these really unique stories. We haven't heard stories quite like this before. Is there anything else that you want to share with us?
Well, God bless America. I hope we can survive. It just kills me to watch the stupidity of our people who are guiding this country. They just don't seem to be in touch with reality. That's just my opinion. That's a big difference between the people that we have now and the people that we had then. President Roosevelt and Harry Truman, they were a different breed of cat. They'll probably never come around again, but I hope they will.
Is there one thing that you're most proud of in being a World War II veteran and being able to wear your Navy colors wherever you go?
Yeah, the other people that I see and are happy to talk to me. That's what I'm most proud of. I would have never, ever had the opportunity to meet people like that as grown up as a cowboy on a Montana ranch.
Well, it all started in Missoula, but next stop, Washington, D.C., in the World War II Memorial. We can't wait to get you there, Harry, with Central Valley Honor Flight. 92-year-old Harry Mercer, many thanks. And speaking of Honor Flight, be there in Lemoore on Tuesday night at 7 to see the Honor Flight documentary. That'll be at the great Golden Eagle Arena at West Hills, Lemoore. Congressman David Valadeo is going to be there to share a few words about what Honor Flight means to him. I hope that I'll see you there, and also that you'll join us again next time here on Hometown Heroes. That's all for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.